Today on the Missouri Review podcast, we're continuing our presentation of the winning entries to our 2007 audio competition. Chris Saknussemm takes the first runner-up position in the narrative essay category with his piece entitled Cahoots. Saknussemm has won first prizes in the Boston Review and River Styx short fiction contests and has published in a wide range of magazines, including Chelsea, The Antioch Review, New Letters, Prairie Schooner, and Zizova. His first novel, Zanesville, was published in 2005 by Villard Books, an imprint of Random House.
I'm Chris Saknussemm. This is a piece called Cahoots. My father got smashed at my high school's father-son athletic awards banquet. They'd organized pre-dinner drinks for the dads, and my dad got pre-dinner drunk. He must have been drinking beforehand. I'd never seen him so incapacitated. His face was red and swollen, and there was a layer of sweat on it, like the condensation on a block of cheese on a humid day. When we filed into the cafeteria for the banquet, things got worse. There was a glass case full of sports trophies and a wooden signboard listing the school's athletic records down through the years. Dad slammed his shoulder against the side on the way past, and a trophy fell over inside. It could have easily rolled like a bowling pin and taken out the whole shelf, or the glass could have shattered. Fortunately, only a small wooden statue with a tiny gold cross-country runner tipped over. Then Dad tipped over. And like the cross-country runner, frozen in mid-stride, he seemed both still and still moving on the floor, as if the change in elevation and direction hadn't registered. By this time, I could feel the eyes all over me. My friend Kyle looked at me with a grimace of apology. I had no idea what to do except to get Dad on his feet, keep moving in line, get seated fast. Maybe some food would sober him up. Some food. I sat him down at one of the long tables and told him to wait while I went to the buffet to fix his plate. I took my eyes off him for 1 minute, and then fear and embarrassment got the better of me and I looked back. He was gone. He'd gone around the other way, nearly pulling a tablecloth out from one setting and almost destroying the circular table that displayed the desserts. Then he found the plates. Everyone cleared away from him. I couldn't seem to move. All I could do was watch him go to work. He plucked and picked and ladled and slathered and piled and crammed and stacked and smushed. It was only when I thought he was going to keel over and take out the whole buffet line that I regained control of my body. I got him back to the table with the help of Kyle's dad, losing dinner rolls and lemon-glazed carrots along the way. I was so angry. So ashamed. Yet I still thought that food would help. The problem was that there was so much food on his plate, he couldn't eat anything without spilling. Some, then more, and more. A disgusting slice of bloody roast beef fell in his lap, and he didn't even notice. Peas tumbled, English mustard smeared, and the sounds he made. Johnny Johnston and his family actually got up and moved to another table. Then suddenly Dad belched, an awful-smelling resonant bark. His head lolled and he pitched forward into his plate, splattering mashed potatoes and gravy. Someone at the table behind us laughed sharply. No one else said a word. The whole hall went silent, everyone looking at my father, who on my side appeared to be sporting a sideburn of tangy cheese cauliflower. Frances Pareda, the sister of one of my friends who was serving drinks, helped me get Dad out of his chair. The mashed potatoes made a muddy sucking sound when we peeled him free. His suit was ruined, but Dr. Abrams was more worried about his breathing. We dragged him into the kitchen and laid him out on one of the long stainless steel benchtops, at the end of which were piled chicken carcasses and a mountain of moist potato skins. Dr. Abrams checked his airway and his pulse, and Francis helped me clean his face with a wet dish towel. When he came around, he needed to go to the bathroom. I carried him under the arms and walked into the men's room like a piece of awkward furniture. Just in time. I pushed open the stall door and he started spewing. I was holding on to him, but the force of the upchuck yanked him loose and he fell forward, smacking his head on the white ceramic tank, then bouncing back, clutching the toilet seat as if he were drowning in the floor. After Dad was emptied out, I endeavored to drive him back to his motel to sleep it off, but after great effort, he managed to inform me that he hadn't come down alone. He'd brought Marty with him. She was back at the motel, and he pleaded with me not to let her see him that way. But if he couldn't go back to the motel, that meant he had to come home with me. That meant smuggling him into my bedroom, because of course I couldn't explain what had happened to my mother and stepfather. They already disapproved of Dad enough without seeing him stained and slurring. I'd slipped out of my room and back in the wee hours many times before, but I'd never attempted so stealthy a maneuver with such a handicap. Worse still, my father's pathological optimism had given him the idea that I'd somehow forgiven him, and that we were old buddies again, partners in crime, tomcatting around. He became giggly and sentimental. He was having a great old time. Like we were sleeping out in a treehouse. I managed to get him out of the house the next morning without my mother and stepfather finding out, but I almost had a nervous breakdown doing it. By that time, the remorse had kicked in, and he barely spoke. I didn't have a thought in my head as to what to say to Marty about where he'd been all night, which proved to be the beginning of the end for that relationship, although Dad, as always, was philosophical about the downturn. Thankfully, Marty wasn't in the motel room when we got there. She'd left a note saying that she was walking along the beach. I left Dad to clean himself up and start thinking of excuses, and went off to find another stretch of beach where I could pull the car over and get some sleep. I was beat. He'd snored heavily during the night. I was sure Mom would hear it. Then, when he stopped snoring, I was afraid he'd stop breathing. I lay there in bed watching him, listening to the clock, until the sound got smaller and smaller. Sometimes he'd talk in his sleep. Once he called out a name, but I didn't recognize it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Missouri Review. To find out more information about the Missouri Review and to see a complete list of the winners of our 2007 audio competition, please visit us at www.missourireview.com.